Good evening, everyone. So as our brother Jeff has mentioned, we will be looking at the prophecy of Malachi this evening. And hopefully for everyone, this proves to be a rather interesting study. I think that the overall tone of this prophecy and its message of warning is very relevant for us today. So to start with, we'd like to look at Malachi himself, to see what we can find out about him. We'd like to look at the background to this book, to see what sort of an environment he was in when he spoke to the people. We'll try and analyze the actual prophecy itself, the book itself, and try and see the structure of it. And then we'll see how far we can get into the actual message before time runs out, and we'll pick it up in our next study, I believe, in the fall. So, basically, there is no information about Malachi, the man. Virtually none at all. So little that some people would suggest that Malachi is actually just a generic term for messenger, as the word means. Perhaps the message could be from some other nameless prophet or even someone like Ezra or Nehemiah. I don't know if that statement can be entirely substantiated, but I'll throw it out anyways. I've always had the impression that there was a man who was named Malachi and he was God's messenger, and this was the message that was delivered by him. Malachi, as we've mentioned, means messenger. It's from the Hebrew word malak. It's actually from an unused root meaning to dispatch as a deputy, a messenger specifically of God, that is an angel, also a prophet, a priest, or a teacher. Can also be used as an ambassador, angel, king, or messenger. And the message that Malachi brings is described as a burden, i.e. the message was to be carried as rebuke or judgment. Criticism and reprimand is certainly part of the prophecy as a result of the actions of the people that we see described in the book of Nehemiah. It's commonly understood that this prophecy occurs after the return from exile of Judah and Israel. Again, there is no phrase that says, in the days of Ezra and Nehemiah or anything like that, but I'll defer to scholars with much more experience than I and go with their statements which place this prophecy of Malachi in this time frame. In approximately 457 BC, which was the seventh year of Artaxerxes II, the people returned from exile under Ezra. And in approximately 444 BC, in the 20th year of Artaxerxes, Nehemiah's work took place, and that's when they suggest Malachi prophesied under a period of time. So let us look then at the context of the events around Nehemiah's day. If we're going to assume that this is when this prophecy is, we've got lots of information in Ezra and Nehemiah about what that time period was like. It's always important for us to understand the background and the circumstances in which letters were written and which prophecy was spoken. It really helps us to understand exactly why specific phrases were said and exactly what their intended purpose was. So we do know that Nehemiah worked with Ezra, the scribe. The people had returned to Jerusalem to rebuild it. It was destroyed by the Babylonians, and they returned to rebuild it and to set it up and to build the walls. I think we're relatively familiar with the story, but it just helps to refresh, of course. Nehemiah chapter 2. We know Nehemiah goes in before the king, and he is sad in the king's presence, which was possibly a death sentence, or could have been. We know it worked out for the best. Certainly God's hand was at work. And Nehemiah was granted his petition to return to the land, and he does. And when he gets there, he goes out at night to just basically see what the situation was, and it says he rides on a beast, and there were some parts of his journey where there wasn't even anywhere for the beast. I'm assuming a donkey or camel or whatever. There wasn't even room for it to go because of the rubble. So this was a situation that he came back. The city was demolished. There was hardly a city to speak of. The land is in an absolute terrible state. So they set out to rebuild the walls, as we know, under opposition from Sanballat, Tobiah, and Geshem, who were people in the land already. They laughed at them. They were incredulous when Nehemiah told them what their plan was. And they figured it would just turn to nothing, but of course they persisted. The Israelites under Nehemiah persisted to rebuild the walls. So, Tobiah, Sanballat and company took to, more desperate measures. So they hired, the Arabians, the Ammonites and the Ashdodites in Nehemiah chapter 4 actually came up to attack them. Nehemiah 4 verses 7 and 8. But it came to pass that when Sanballat and Tobiah and the Arabians and the Ammonites and the Ashdodites heard that the walls of Jerusalem were made up and that the breaches began to be stopped, that they were very wroth and conspired all of them together to come and to fight against Jerusalem and to hinder it. Nevertheless, they made their prayer to God and continued on with the work. So Nehemiah sets up a defense policy, and we know that he gives everyone who is working a sword or a spear with them, and they set up watches. They were not going to be deterred by anything, really, and so they continued to work. They even hired, this is Tobiah and Sanballat, even hired people to kind of go on the inside to try and deceive them. We read that in Nehemiah chapter 6, verses 10 down to 14. Afterward, I came to the house of Shemaiah, the son of Deliah, the son of Mehetabel, who was shut up, and he said, "Let us meet together in the house of God within the temple, and let us shut the doors of the temple, for they will come to slay thee. Yea, in the night they will come to slay thee." And I said, and this is Nehemiah, and I said, "Should such a man as I flee? And who is there that, being as I am, would go into the temple to save his life? I will not go in." And lo, I perceived that God had not sent him, but that he pronounced this prophecy against me, for Tobiah and Sanballat had hired him. Therefore was he hired that I should be afraid and do so and sin, that they might have matter for an evil report, that they might reproach me. So, actually, let's continue verse 14 as well. "My God, think thou upon Tobiah and Sanballat according to their works, and on the prophetess Noadiah and the rest of the prophets that would have put me in fear." So not only did they have it externally, literally in the face of brandished weapons, but Tobiah and Sanballat even sought to hinder their work from within and hire conspirators and spies. Now, in the face of this, of course, they continue to build and build and build, and they complete the walls. Also, we read of Ezra instructing the people and teaching them from the law of Moses in Nehemiah chapter 8. And we have one of my dad's favorite verses in Nehemiah chapter 8, verse 8. "So they read in the book of the law of God distinctly and gave the sense and caused them to understand the reading." And that's really, I think, what the key of this is that the people needed to understand they'd been in captivity for so long, and I'm sure a lot of their knowledge and their understanding of the law had faded or perhaps disappeared altogether. And so it was vital for Ezra to really hammer home these principles and make it very clear to the end that they understood, and that was the whole point. So they held the Feast of Tabernacles, or the Feast of Booths. Chapter 9 is a confession of God's goodness, at the end of which, in verse 38 of chapter 9, "And because of all this confession," which we won't read in chapter 9, "and because of all this, we make a sure covenant and write it, and our princes, Levites, and priests seal unto it." So at the end of this feast, they'd come to this great understanding and this great confession of God and his power, and they make a covenant here at the end of chapter 9. And in Nehemiah chapter 10, there's a list of all the people who agree to this covenant. And we'll just go over what they said, because it's important. It's really actually, I think, pivotal to understanding Malachi, what it was that they covenanted here in Nehemiah chapter 10. So we'll just read verses 28 down to 39, and it outlines exactly what this covenant was all about. And the rest of the people, the priests, the Levites, the porters, the singers, the Nethinim, and all they that had separated themselves from the people of the lands unto the law of God, their wives, their sons, and their daughters, everyone having knowledge and having understanding. So we go back to Ezra educating the people. So they had knowledge and they had understanding. Just kind of as an aside, I mean, we can relate that certainly to our baptism. We have to go through a process of learning until we have knowledge, until we have understanding, so that we are able to make that commitment of baptism. So continuing in verse 29, they clave to their brethren, their nobles, and entered into a curse and into an oath to walk in God's law, which was given by Moses, the servant of God, and to observe and to do all the commandments of the Lord, our Lord, and his judgments and his statutes, and that we would not give our daughters unto the people of the land, nor take their daughters for our sons. And if the people of the land bring ware or any victuals on the Sabbath day to sell, that we would not buy it of them on the Sabbath or on the holy day, and that we would leave the seventh year in the exaction of every debt. Also, we made ordinances for us to charge ourselves yearly with the third part of a shekel for the service of the house of God, for the showbread and for the continual meal offering and for the continual burnt offering of the Sabbaths, of the new moons, and for the set feasts, and for the holy things, and for the sin offerings, to make an atonement for Israel, and for all the work of the house of our God. And we cast the lots among the priests, the Levites, and the people, for the wood offering, and to bring it into the house of our God, after the houses of our fathers, at times appointed year by year, to burn upon the altar of the Lord our God, as it is written in the law. And to bring the first fruits of our ground, and the first fruits of all fruit of all trees, year by year, unto the house of the Lord. Also, the firstborn of our sons and of our cattle, as it is written in the law, and the firstlings of our herds and of our flocks, to bring to the house of our God, unto the priests that minister in the house of our God, and that we should bring the first fruits of our dough, and our offerings, and the fruit of all manner of trees, of wine, and of oil, unto the priests, to the chambers of the house of our God, and the tithes of our ground unto the Levites, that the same Levites might, have the tithes in all the cities of our tillage. And the priests, the sons of Aaron, shall be with the Levites when the Levites take the tithes, and the Levites shall bring up the tithe of the tithes unto the house of our God, to the chambers, into the treasure house. For the children of Israel and the children of Levi shall bring the offering of the corn, of the new wine, and the oil, unto the chambers where are the vessels of the sanctuary, and the priests that minister, and the porters, and the singers. And we will not forsake the house of our God. And sorry, it was a bit of a long reading, but it's really important, because this is what the people agreed to. They all got together and they sat down, and this big commitment here, and they agreed to it, and that's what they said. And just quickly to pick out the points, verse 29, they had knowledge and they had understanding, and that was absolutely pivotal. In verse 30, they agreed not to intermarry. They said, we won't do this. We will not mix with the other people. So that's one key point. Verse 31, they covenanted to observe the Sabbath. Specifically, they said, that's it. We're keeping the Sabbath. Verse 32 and 33, a taxation to support temporal operation. That was a specific thing that they agreed to. Verses 34 to 37, all the feasts and the burnt offerings and the appointed times, they'd agreed to keep all those things. Verses 38 and 39 was the tithing. They'd specifically picked out these things, and it was a tithing that they agreed to do. And, of course, the very last phrase in the chapter, we will not forsake the house of our God. So their commitment to the temple and to its operation. So this is key, as I've said. This commitment here that they'd made was what they'd made. And there's several key points which we picked out of it. Now, unfortunately, as we continue on in Nehemiah, by the time we get to chapter 13, Nehemiah is in back in Persia, as we read in verse 6 of chapter 13, but in all this time was not I at Jerusalem, for in the 2 and 30th year of Artaxerxes, king of Babylon, came I unto the king, and after certain days obtained I leave of the king. So Nehemiah left for a while and went back to Persia, and unfortunately in that time that he was away, everything kind of collapsed. All this extremely high standards and this commitment that they'd made, they let it go. They let it all slide. Eliashib, the priest, allied himself with Tobiah, who had set up a chamber where all the offerings of the Lord were kept. So Tobiah, their arch enemy, so to speak, had his own little office right in the temple. So Nehemiah starts to begin his reform and to point out everything that's going on here. And we picked out those very specific things in their covenant when we read Nehemiah chapter 13, verses 10 to 14. And I perceived that the portions of the Levites had not been given them. For the Levites and the singers that did the work were fed everyone on his own field, on his field. Then I contended with the rulers and said, why is the house of God forsaken? Isn't that interesting? We just read in chapter 10 that they said very specifically, we will not forsake the house of our God. Halfway through verse 11, why is the house of God forsaken? And I gathered them together and set them in their place. Then brought all Judah the tithe of the corn and the new wine and the oil unto the treasury. So they start to begin this again with the tithes. And I made treasurers over the treasuries, Shelemiah the priest and Zadok the scribe, and of the Levites, Pedaiah, and next unto them was Hannah and Sola. And he starts to set up this the system again, which had so soon deteriorated when he left. Verses 15 to 22, maybe we won't actually read it all. The Sabbath had been rejected. Again, one of the very, very specific things that they had promised to keep. The Sabbath had been rejected. And in verses 23 to 27, they had intermarried. To the point of, when we read in verse 28, that one of the sons of Joiada, the son of Eliashib, the high priest, was son-in-law to Sanballat, the Horonite. So the grandson of the high priest married the daughter of Sanballat. Again, they were just completely mixing in with these people that they had given them so many problems before. And in verses 29 down to 31, the priesthood was completely defiled, and strangers were in the congregation. So Nehemiah basically had to organize the priests and the Levites, and he structured the wood offerings and the first fruits, and that's what we get to. That's what we get to at the end of the book. So we had quite a roller coaster ride, I guess, right from the very beginning when they came back into the land of building the wall under extreme oppression, to the point where they'd kind of got it set up, the literal building set up, and their offerings and their system of worship was all organized through major trial. Of course, they built the temple, which was a significantly less spectacular structure than Solomon's temple. They warded off the inhabitants of the land and established this righteous system of worship. But then they started to falter, of course. And once Nehemiah wasn't right there, kind of cracking the whip, it all started to fall apart. And what's interesting, isn't it, is that it wasn't the war or the persecution that got them, was it? It wasn't Tobiah and Sanballat with their swords chasing them down that got them. It wasn't all those trials or tests that crippled them. It was the peace. It was once everything was established and everything was set that they started to falter. Their guard dropped, and the world was accepted into their lives. And I think that's a pretty powerful lesson for us. This whole message of Malachi, or that comes out of Malachi, it's perfect for us right now. We don't have people threatening to tear this building down. We don't have the authorities on us. We're not really persecuted in any way. Yet it seems in this modern age of tolerance and acceptance that the influence of the world is more pervasive in our lives than it ever has been. So this is really the backdrop that Malachi brings the burden of the word of the Lord to the people of Israel. So the book itself, Malachi itself, can be broken up quite concisely into 8 sections. It's actually quite interesting how it breaks down. Each section is sort of defined by an accusation or a statement from God, which is kind of smugly retorted to by the people and questioned. And then that statement is again confirmed and judgment is passed by God. And the breakdown sort of goes like this. And if you've got a pencil or a ruler or something, it's might be kind of nice to just mark off these sections in your margin. Section 1 is from Malachi 1, verses 1 to 5. And it's kind of an introduction and an appeal to the people. Malachi 1, 1 to 5. Starting in verse 6 of chapter 1, we have the second section down to verse 14, to the end of chapter 1, which is really rebuking the priesthood, the corrupt priesthood. Starting in chapter 2, verse 1, is another section, verses 1 down to 9, which describes punishment upon the priests. Chapter 2, starting in verse 10 to 16, talks about intermarriage with the nations being condemned. Starting in verse 17 of chapter 2, right through to chapter 3 and verse 6, talks about God's coming judgment. Starting in verse 7 of chapter 3 down to verse 12, it talks about the neglect of the tithes and offerings. And in chapter 3, verse 13, right down to chapter 4, verse 3, this is speaking for and against God. And then the final three verses, verses 4 to 6 of chapter 4, are kind of a conclusion and some exhortation. And if you just mark those off, that's great. If you want to write in kind of the titles that I've suggested, you can come see me after. I didn't put this on PowerPoint, so I'm very sorry. So that's kind of a section breakdown of the book. And really there is certain kind of key verses that really epitomize each of those sections. And it's in this dialogue, for lack of a better word, between God and the people and back to God again. And we'll just pick them out. There's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. There's 8 verses. And they really kind of epitomize this. And the first is in the first section, chapter 1 and verse 2. It says, God says, I have loved you, saith the Lord. So there's God's statement. And the people say, yet ye say, wherein hast thou loved us? And then God answers again, was not Esau Jacob's brother, saith the Lord? Yet I loved Jacob. So that's kind of our first statement, which really epitomizes that first section, verses 1 to 5. The next section, which is verses 6 down to the end of chapter 1, has 2 of these verses, verses 6 and 7. A son honoreth his father and a servant his master, God says. If then I be a father, where is mine honor? And if I be a master, where is my fear? Saith the Lord of hosts unto you, O priests that despise my name. And ye say, wherein have we despised thy name? The people answer back. God says in verse 7, ye offer polluted bread upon mine altar. And the people say, wherein? Wherein have we polluted thee? And God says, in that ye say, the table of the Lord is contemptible. And again, that kind of epitomizes that section from verses 6 down to 14, talking, where's my notes here? Really rebuking the priesthood in that section, verses 6 to 14. When we come down to chapter 2 and verse 14 is our next one, really verse 13, I guess. And this ye have done again, covering the altar of the Lord with tears and weeping and with crying out, insomuch that ye regard not the offering any more, or receive it with goodwill at your hand. Yet ye say, wherefore? You know, how have we done this? Why? We don't understand. And the Lord answers, because the Lord hath been witness between thee and the wife of thy youth. And again, this is in this section talking about intermarriage with the nations. Chapter 2, verse 17, ye have wearied the Lord with your words, is God's statement. Yet ye say, wherein have we wearied him? God answers, when ye say, everyone that doeth evil is good in the sight of the Lord, and he delighteth in them. Or where is the judgment of God? Epitomizing the section about God's coming judgments. Chapter 3, verse 7. Even from the days of your fathers, you are gone away from mine ordinances and have not kept them. Return unto me, and I will return unto you, saith the Lord of hosts. But ye say, wherein shall we return? In verse 8, will a man rob God? Yet ye have robbed me, but ye say, wherein have you robbed me? You can see this kind of exchange back and forth really throughout the whole book, and each one kind of really picks out its own section. And the final one then is in chapter 3, verse 13. Your words have been stout against me, saith the Lord. Yet ye say, what have we spoken so much against thee? Ye have said, it is vain to serve God. And what profit is it that we have kept his ordinances, and so on. So this is kind of an interesting pattern that's true for the most of the sections, apart from the third section, which is just God's straight judgment upon the priests. The priests are punished in that third section. And also in the very, very last section, which is the last three verses of chapter 4, which is just kind of a wrap-up and some encouragement. So when we look at the breakdown of these sections, I think we can see that there's indirect evidence for this prophecy being issued in the time frame that we have suggested. Although it doesn't say, as we mentioned, it doesn't specifically say, and in the days of Nehemiah or any of that, when we look at the issues that are addressed in Malachi, the tithes, the corrupt priesthood, the intermarriage, and that kind of stuff, these are the exact issues that were going on in the time of Nehemiah. And I don't think we really need it to say in the days of Ezra or Nehemiah, because the issues that are addressed and the things that are talked about are the same things. Remembering back, of course, to Nehemiah chapter 10 that we read, Israel had intermarried, even though they had covenanted that they never would. They had neglected the Sabbath, even though they covenanted that they never would. They neglected the tithes and the support of the temple, and their priesthood was completely corrupt. So these are precisely the things that Malachi addresses in his prophecy. And so I think it actually fits very well to place this prophecy in that generation. So we'll get into the actual text and start to go through it. Starting with the first section, we'll just read through the first section just for continuity's sake, so it's fresh in our minds. Starting in Malachi chapter 1, verses 1 to 5, the burden of the word of the Lord to Israel by Malachi. I have loved you, saith the Lord. Yet ye say, wherein hast thou loved us? Was not Esau Jacob's brother, saith the Lord? Yet I have loved Jacob. And I hated Esau, and laid his mountains and his heritage waste for the dragons of the wilderness. Whereas Edom saith, we are impoverished, but we will return and build the desolate places. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, they shall build, but I will throw down. And they shall call them the border of wickedness, and the people against whom the Lord hath indignation forever. And your eyes shall see, and ye shall say, the Lord will be magnified from the border of Israel. So God emphatically states that he has loved his people. Verse 2, I have loved you, saith the Lord. You can't get much more plain than that. And we just turn over to Jeremiah chapter 31, verses 3 and 4. Jeremiah 31, verses 3 and 4. The Lord hath appeared of old unto me, saying, yea, I have loved thee with an everlasting love. Therefore, with loving kindness have I drawn thee. Again, I will build thee, and thou shalt be built, O Virgin of Israel, and thou shalt again be adorned with thy tabrets, and shalt go forth in the dances of them that make merry. It's an interesting prophecy of Jeremiah, specifically in reference to building. I mean, that would have been so fresh in the people's minds. Although it doesn't specifically say building in Malachi, but if they used their margin and their cross-references, they could have read it. talking about building, and it's interesting as God says that he's loved them of old, and it just emphasizes that statement. And then, of course, we have the challenge from the people saying, you know, wherein have you loved us? And it seems remarkable, doesn't it, to us that these, of all people, would question God's love for them. But God says, look, Esau was Jacob's brother, right? There's two brothers, but I chose Jacob. That's it. I chose. God can do as he pleases, and God says, I chose Jacob. I chose you. But the people question God's love. They question, you know, wherein have you loved us? So God proves it to them. He proves it by saying, I've chosen you. We turn to Romans chapter 9. And verses 10 to 13. And not only this, but when Rebekah also had conceived by one, even by our father Isaac, for the children being not yet born, neither having done any good or evil, that the purpose of God according to election might stand, not of works, but of him that calleth, it was said to her, the elder shall serve the younger. As it is written, Jacob have I loved, but Esau have I hated. And it's not unfair or unjust on God's part. It's just a fact. And God says, look, I have chosen Jacob. I have loved Jacob. And that's part of his response to the people here. And he goes on and talks about Edom or Esau Esau being cursed in verse 3 and in verse 4. And then when it continues down to verse 5, and your eyes shall see, and ye shall say, the Lord will be magnified from the border of Israel. And we just turn over to Psalm 91 for some insight on that. Psalm 91, verses 8 to 10. Only with thine eyes shalt thou behold and see the reward of the wicked, because thou hast made the Lord, which is my refuge, even the Most High, thy habitation. There shall no evil befall thee, neither shall any plague come nigh thy dwelling. And so the people witnessed the destruction. It talks about the curse on Edom, and the children of Israel actually witnessed that. So right off the top, it's like Israel is questioning God's existence by saying, do you love us? It seems a little incredible that they actually required God to prove that to them. After all he'd done for their fathers, and after all he'd done for them just a few years ago by bringing them into the land. It was just a matter of years since they'd returned from Babylon, yet they're already questioning God's love for them. And so he has to prove it to them. I think one other point I missed here. Israel enjoyed God's blessing, while Edom did not. And this blessing of Israel, the fact that Israel was blessed, magnified God's name. When the nations looked around and saw Israel being blessed and chosen, that actually was witness to the fact that God loved them, and that should have been the people's answer right there, that his people were their witnesses. So we'll get into the next section here. I don't know how far we'll get through it. Starting in verse 6, and we'll just read through it. A son honoreth his father, and a servant his master. If then I be a father, where is mine honor? God says, and if I be a master, where is my fear? Saith the Lord of hosts unto you, O priests that despise my name. And ye say, wherein have we despised thy name? Ye offer polluted bread upon mine altar. And ye say, wherein have we polluted thee? In that ye say, the table of the Lord is contemptible. And if ye offer the blind for a sacrifice, is it not evil? And if ye offer the lame and sick, is it not evil? Offer it now unto thy governor. Will he be pleased with thee, or accept thy person, saith the Lord of hosts? And now I pray you, beseech God, that he will be gracious unto us. This hath been by your means. Will he regard your persons, saith the Lord of hosts? Who is there, even among you, that would shut the doors for naught? Neither do you kindle a fire on mine altar for naught. I have no pleasure in you, saith the Lord of hosts, neither will I accept an offering at your hand. For from the rising of the sun, Even unto the going down of the same, my name shall be great among the Gentiles, and in every place incense shall be offered unto my name, and a pure offering. For my name shall be great among the heathen, saith the Lord of hosts. But ye have profaned it, in that ye say, the table of the Lord is polluted, and the fruit thereof, even his meat, is contemptible. Ye said also, behold, what a weariness it is. And ye have snuffed at it, saith the Lord of hosts, and ye brought that which was torn, and the lame, and the sick. Thus ye brought an offering. Should I accept this of your hand, saith the Lord? But cursed be the deceiver, which hath in his flock a male, and voweth and sacrificeth unto the Lord a corrupt thing. For I am a great king, saith the Lord of hosts, and my name is dreadful among the heathen. And verse 6 begins with a reference to the first commandment, of course, honor your father and mother in Exodus 20, verse 12. God was Israel's father, as we read in Hosea chapter 11. Hosea 11, verses 1, 4, and 8. When Israel was a child, then I loved him and called my son out of Egypt. Verse 4. I drew them with cords of a man and bands of love. And I was to them as they that take off the yoke upon their jaws, and I laid meat unto them. And verse 8. How shall I give thee up, Ephraim? How shall I deliver thee, Israel? And how shall I make thee as Admah? How shall I set thee as Zeboim? Mine heart is turned within me. My repentings are kindled together. I think this is pretty emotional language by God talking about the people of Israel here, describing them as his children. And we continue to see this, of course, God's care for them, as they are front and center in the world events. So verses 6 and 7 contain two charges by God, two responses, and two answers, as we've read. These are directed at the spiritual leaders of the people, the priests, of course, and their failure to maintain proper worship by the people and order in the house of God. The priests were accepting things that were clearly not acceptable to God, as we read in verse 8. The people were offering blind and lame sacrifices. Down in verse 13, that which was torn and that which was sick. And the priests were accepting that. The priests were taking those unacceptable offerings by the people and offering them to God. And it's remarkable that they show surprise and ignorance when God condemns them in verse 7. They certainly felt his condemnation as a result of this. Verse 7, the word polluted, has a primitive root to soil, or figuratively to desecrate, defile, to pollute, stain. It's used in a couple of other verses. Verse 12 is one here in Malachi chapter 1. But ye have profaned it, in that ye say, the table of the Lord is polluted, and the fruit thereof, even his meat, is contemptible. We read it also in Nehemiah chapter 13, verse 29. Nehemiah 13, verse 29, remember them, O my God, because they have defiled the priesthood and the covenant of the priesthood and of the Levites. And that word defiled there is the same. And also quickly over in Daniel chapter 1, and verse 8, which is certainly a contrast, a very heartwarming contrast, to say the least. Daniel chapter 1, verse 8, but Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the portion of the king's meat, nor with the wine which he drank. Therefore he requested of the prince of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself. And it's the same word there again. So it's interesting that the priest considered the table of the Lord to be polluted and to be corrupt. And the word governor in verse 8, which God challenges him. He says, try offering this stuff to your governor and see what he says. That governor there is referred to as a governor of foreign origin, or a prefect, or of a city, or a small district, a captain, a deputy, or a governor, perhaps. That could be in reference to, I think Tobiah was the governor of the land. And in verse 12, we have reference to the table of the Lord, that phrase, the table of the Lord being polluted and the bread. And it's not just the bread, but the flesh that was sacrificed also. And maybe as a bit of an exhortation here to wrap up, we can think of our own partaking of the sacrifice each Sunday morning here. As we eat of the bread, is the table of the Lord polluted in our eyes? What do we think of when we partake of the emblems? Are we really focusing on Christ's sacrifice, on our shortcomings and the need of forgiveness? Perhaps we're thinking about dinner in the oven or what we're going to do for the rest of the day. And we'll just finish with a verse in John chapter 6. Maybe as a reminder for us. John chapter 6 and verses 53 and 54. Then Jesus said unto them, Verily, verily, I say unto you, except ye eat the flesh of the Son of Man and drink his blood, ye have no life in you. Whoso eateth my flesh and drinketh my blood hath eternal life, and I will raise him up at the last day. So we'll continue on with this study then in a couple of months.